show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky here, yes indeed, as promised, it is a live show. I'm home from the Irma Bird Center, which itself is the home of the PRISM West Virginia American History Summer Academy, going on this week and Monday of next week. I hope you've been tuning in, because there's been nothing short of amazing lectures and tremendous American history to be learned. Fascinating stuff. We heard last night and today from Dr. Robert Bliss. This afternoon, Dr. Carson. Oh, shame on me. Where do the names go? I'll think of it in a minute in the middle of the conversation. But anyway, fascinating discussions of rights and liberties. It will continue into labor rights and the development of labor rights in this country on Thursday. Dr. Bill will be talking about American exceptionalism, quote unquote, on Thursday evening. Foreign policy on Friday with an absolute world-renowned scholar on the topic. Yes, indeed. If you're not tuned in to the PRISM West Virginia American History Series, you're missing a bunch. Now, as far as the schedule goes, there will be live programs, obviously, tonight, and live programming tomorrow evening as well for prayer meeting Wednesday. No live show on Thursday night, maybe a live show on Friday, depending on when we wrap up. And then Monday is still up in the air, too. After that, we go back to something. Well, after that, I'm on the road next week to a mountaintop removal meeting. My apologies. That we were able to do shows in D.C., but this one will preclude. This will be the preclusive of shows. But anyway, we got one tonight. We got one tomorrow night, probably Friday night. So that's nice. And so this is Thorn in no, that's Thorn in the Side. This is Titanic Tuesday. I'm sorry, this just it all runs together after a while. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, Head On Radio Network, headonradionetwork.com. We like to call what we do here conversation radio, and you are more than welcome to join in. Speaking of conversations, we will be talking to Dr. Bill O'Brien himself in the second hour of the program. At least that was the plan when I left the Bird Center. I expect to hear from Dr. Bill probably along about 7 o'clock my time. And I think you'll get a lot out of that, because we're going to talk about some of the stuff that's coming up. We hope, let's put it this way. We're going to add another program to the Horn lineup. You know, once upon a time, let's see, John Fox, Peter Godbold, Joe Vecchio, me. Once upon a time, we had something approaching 12 hours a day of programming on the Horn. Now we have 6. We add in Dr. Bill, we'll be back to 8, maybe eventually 9. And I think you'll find what Dr. Bill has to offer to be particularly interesting, simply because his focus is so intense with regard to the whole raison d'etre, if I'm saying it right, of why this nation was founded the way it was. If you've tuned in for any of his American history chats on Sunday afternoons and so forth, you know how intense and document-based that can be. Had a fascinating discussion with Dr. Robert Bliss this morning about a letter called What is an American by a man named De Crèvecoeur. Fascinating. Well worth looking up. But no, this is the Horn, Conversation Radio's very own home. And we look forward, all of us, and when I say we, I'm not talking about me and that mouse in my pocket, I'm talking about the entire Horn family. We like to hear what you have to offer. We like to hear your, we all like to hear, it's participatory is what I'm trying to get at. And that's what makes things so incredibly special. The Horn is available, of course, on a wide variety of internet platforms. Of course, the easiest way to get it is simply to go to headonradionetwork.com and click the Listen Live button. Bang, bang, you're there. But you can also listen via the stream at whiterosesociety.org. You can listen on iTunes Radio. You can listen via podcast at iTunes or whiterosesociety.org. You can listen live or the previous day's programming at Stitcher Internet Radio, and you can also listen live to the 24/7 stream, either live at this point in time or the day's show in rerun at both Tuner Internet Radio and TuneIn Radio. Yeah, Dr. John just dropped a note and said, incredibly excited to hear details, hoping the crappy wireless in the Fleabag Motel can hold out. Maybe get some help from the fleas, Dr. John. I think Dr. John's on the road, and we wish him the very best. So I've been immersed, and that's what the Prism, I love the Prism program because it is immersive. You have to think about this. You have to take this history into consideration, and it can't help but lead you to wonder, or maybe stop wondering how it is we got where we are. Because some of this stuff paints a pretty bright picture of how we got where we are. And of course, I'm constantly listening to all the material and paying attention and getting the stream out and stuff. At the same time thinking, but wait a minute, what about those yahoos who just make their own history up? And we know who we're talking about here, right? Because it's a lot harder for them to get away with it if we know the facts. Right? Brilliant discussion this afternoon, for instance, of things like the slaughterhouse cases and Lochner. I know if you've listened to Sandra's phone calls from time to time, she will bring up the slaughterhouse cases and Lochner, and there's a reason for it. This currently constituted incredibly creepy Supreme Court has all the earmarks of the same court that gave us the slaughterhouse cases and Lochner and Plessy versus Ferguson. You know, some of the ickiest decisions ever to emanate from that body. Carson Holloway. Dr. Carson Holloway. My apologies, Doc. It's been a long day. It's been a couple of long days. I identify in a big way with what Dr. John's talking about, if the wireless in the motel holds up. I'd get back to the motel. What happens between hitting the pillow and the alarm going off the next morning, I don't think you can really call sleeping. I guess I've gotten to that point in my life where I don't sleep well when I'm not near Agnes, and that's just a fact. I would rather sleep in the rain with Agnes near me than by myself in the Four Seasons Hotel. What can I tell you? Marriage will do that to you. And I don't think it's something you ever get broke of. I wanted to share a note with you. I'm not going to share the whole thing, but I wanted to share a note with you that came in over the weekend. Just a very nice compliment, and I won't name the sender. But this is a compliment not so much to me, or at least that's not the way I took it. It's not so much a compliment to me, but a compliment to you. It's an email, or a lengthy one, that I received over the weekend. This sentence struck me as being particularly telling and why I share it with you. The second reason I write is to thank you for creating a space of political fellowship, if only a small space, where I do not feel so completely under siege. We all feel that from time to time, don't we? So this is why I've glommed onto your show and your program's obvious humanity. You run a program that just overflows with interpersonal respect, genuine caring for those who are suffering, and delight in sharing accurate knowledge. Wow. It continues, I was quite moved and impressed by how cordial your regular chat room occupants were to me the other night when I entered your show's chat room for the first time. Although many of them came from very different parts of the country and it seemed quite different personal backgrounds, they were all impeccably cordial and friendly. I was truly moved to tears by their friendliness, and a few of them even remembered my call to you. This was also quite extraordinary to me, at least in my recent life. Your Radio Horn family, it seemed to me, engaged in an analogous effort to the one you had made from your studio to bring out the welcome mat. And that was also a memorable experience for me. Well, this note was a memorable experience for me. And I tried to respond in such fashion as to speak not only for myself, but for the kind words offered y'all. It feels a lot like a family, what we have created here over these last few years, and I hope it always does. And if you have never called a radio program, there were a couple of examples in the last week or so of folks doing exactly that and surviving. We have never yet had to call 911 for someone fainting dead away while trying to carry on a conversation on the horn. You'll be fine, too. This is, I don't know, to some small extent, I hope that this is an invitation not just to participate in the conversation, but to participate in the civic life of this, what remains of our nation. At least that's a goal. So later on in the evening, don't feel shy. Pick up the phone, dial the number. You will find yourself welcome, and you will find what you have to say to be treated with dignity and respect and the importance that it deserves. Because there are a lot of people in this country who have every bit as much expertise as the so-called experts, and that informs the operating philosophy of this program. It takes a lot of brains and a lot of courage and a lot of drive just to survive in this country. It takes a hell of a lot more courage and a hell of a lot more brains and a hell of a lot more drive to survive in this country as a member of the 99% than it does to get up every morning and say, oh dear, shall I drive the Lamborghini or the Ferrari today? Whatever shall we have for lunch? Lobster or Kobe beef? Doesn't it? I think it does. So the invitation is there. And yes, I will go ahead and note that this program and this network are listener supported. No one has ever been sent a bill. No one has ever been asked to pay anything they could contribute, not pay. Contribute. We're trying to work on a different model here. we've asked people to make sure that they are not harming themselves when they contribute to the program. But we do live on listener contributions. This network, this effort, subsists on listener contributions. We are on this seventh day of August, 10% toward our August goal, when fact of the matter is, in order to stay on track, we ought to be 25%. And that means we're in a 15% hole. You know, about $625 is where we ought to be. We're at $250. And we sure can use your help. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. And the snail mail address is too. So thank you very kindly, those of you who do keep things going, and those of you who wish you could but cannot. It's okay. Sooner or later, everything comes around, and we all figure out a way to keep this going. So thank you. Now, when I do step away from the microphone to do things like the PRISM West Virginia American History Summer Academy, it means by definition that I'm not here doing this. And last night was tough. It was tough not to be behind the microphone last night. I dare say even trying. Because when you see just manifest weirdness running over the series of tubes, and to have awakened and seen the horror perpetrated in Wisconsin, I'm not going to talk for 3 hours about what happened in Wisconsin, because it's not that far different from what happened in Aurora, Colorado, which was not that far different from what happened in Columbine, Colorado, which was not far that far different from what happened in Blacksburg, Virginia, which is not that far from what happened in Knoxville, Tennessee, which was not that far from what happened in Alabama, which was not that far from what happened in Pennsylvania, which was not that far, not that far, not that far, not that far. I'll say what I always say. We've just laid down another installment payment in blood, of course, in innocent human blood, on the deal with the devil that we have for our fetishization of firearms. Oh, and by the way, yeah, the killer in Wisconsin, the skinhead, the freaking Nazi! Yeah, that guy obtained his firearm legally, too. Now, he's dead, so we can't do any psychological testing on him, mind you. But he wasn't crazy. Very few of these people are crazy. Jared Lee Loeffner pled guilty today in Arizona for the massacre that claimed the lives of some and rendered others permanently maimed. He pled guilty. It is interesting to note that he pled guilty after he had been found by a court of competent jurisdiction to be competent himself to enter his guilty plea. Because no judge will allow a guilty plea to be entered by a crazy person, by an insane person, by a person, by a person who is profoundly mentally ill and unable to understand the consequences of her actions, or his. Jared Lee Loeffner entered a plea that will put him in prison in Arizona for the rest of his life, without chance of parole. He did so to avoid the death penalty. He was also apparently heavily medicated. Apparently the only phrase he could repeat was, "I plead guilty." He said it in the course of the inquiry by the judge 19 times. He obtained, you will recall, his firearms legally from a licensed gun dealer who made a determination at the time and point of sale that he was competent to buy a gun. The same situation that obtained with the murderer in Wisconsin, Wade Michael Page, age 40, skinhead, who also went to a federally licensed firearms dealer, plunked down his money, and purchased his engine of death. Now remember, of course, that Fat Tony Scalia, the son of the head of the pro-Mussolini organization in the United States during the 1930s, remember that Fat Tony Scalia recently said that the Second Amendment might very well cover handheld grenade launchers. Oh boy! Can't wait till we can buy those at the local Wally World or Bass Pro Shop or Squirrel Guns R Us or Second Amendment Emporium and walk away Murder R Us, yeah, whatever. No, he really said that. Fat Tony Scalia, who has opined in the past that the Constitution of the United States does not give you a right not to be killed by the state if you happen to be not guilty, really, really not guilty, and really he said that. Fat Tony Scalia said that because it's handheld grenade launchers may be legal for citizens to own in the United States. I tell you what. You ever wonder if that man has a conscience? Because, see, I don't. I know he doesn't. Oh, sure, he might wear a piece of barbed wire wrapped around his leg or a hair shirt or something, but the man has no conscience. Otherwise, he wouldn't say such crap as that. Because sooner, once that horse is out of the barn, it won't be long until the National Rifle Association is threatening legislators that they will drive them from office unless they stand up for their latest right to keep and bear grenade launchers bill. I'm not being facetious. That's factual. That's how the NRA operates. Doubt me? I mean, you're free to. Doubters are welcome here. But there it is. 3 days after the massacre in Aurora, Colorado, the National Rifle Association put out a mailer nationwide, hustling for money. This is the text from that mailer. The future of your Second Amendment rights will be at stake, and nothing less than the future of our country and our freedom will be at stake. From what? The re-election of Barack Hussein Obama. Yeah, no kidding. The letter goes on and it says that Obama's re-election will result in what it calls the confiscation of our firearms and a ban on semi-automatic weapons. Because, you know, that's how, I don't know about you, but that's how I define freedom. It went on like this for 4 dadgum pages. It went out over the signature of Wayne LaPierre, and it was designed specifically to gin up money to run ads against people who are getting a little bit tired of paying the bloody butcher's bill that the NRA insists on continuing to submit to this nation. Here's what's interesting. Guess how the world found out that 3 days after this massacre in Aurora, Colorado, the NRA had gone out hustling for money on BS bogus claims about threats to our precious freedom to own our guns. A former Republican U.S. lawmaker who asked not to be identified turned the letter over to the media. And the NRA will not admit to having sent it. The NRA will not own up to its own bloodthirsty acts. But see, they need money because their membership dues monies are down by 14% between 2010 and 2008. On the other hand, who needs dues? Their gifts and other contributions are up to 26% from 16% in the same time period. The National Rifle Association sits on a blood-sodden, soaked puddle of money, about $228 million high. They have raised $10 million on the backs of corpses between January 2011 and June 30th, 2012. Jesus God. And the money they were trying to hustle 3 days after the Aurora massacre was to be used for what they call hundreds of thousands of TV and radio ads, especially in a handful of key swing states. They have no shame. Jesus Christ, if they had any shame, they wouldn't be the NRA. They wouldn't be mailing out a fundraising hustle even before the first spade of earth had been turned over the NRA's latest cache of victims. There's always someone out there willing to make an excuse for the NRA, though. In this case, it was Colorado State Shooting Association President Tony Fabian. He said the fundraising letter had probably been in the works a considerable amount of time before the Aurora massacre. And, you know, once you've started a fundraising letter, it doesn't matter what happens between then and when the letter goes out. The letter's got to go out once you start it, right? I mean, after all. Well, these fundraising strategies require a lot of months of planning and scheduling. It looks like the timing is purely a coincidence. Yeah, coincidental death. Coincidental murder. What's that Aerosmith song? I don't have it here, by the way. What's that Aerosmith song? Same old song and dance? Yeah, once a DJ, always a DJ. There it is. It's a lot more fun to play the song, but no. It just kind of fits, doesn't it? You know, song lyrics are just poetry. Get yourself cooler. Lay yourself low. Coincidental murder. With nothing to show. With the judge, constipation will go to his head, and his wife's aggravation, you're soon enough dead. It's the Same old story, same old song and dance, my friend. Jesus, I feel like William Shatner here. Got you with the cocaine they found with your gun. No smoothie face lawyer to get you undone. Yeah. That's what it is, though. Same old song and dance. Now, never mind that the song is the keening of grief-stricken parents or spouses or children or yeah. And the dance, well, it's a sort of a tango on a blood-slicky floor. But the NRA loves that dance. Jim writing in, he says, grenade launchers? Ever used or been on the receiving end of same? It's not a paint gun or a Roman candle, you know. Madness. Yes, it is madness, Jim. But now that Fat Tony Scalia has green-lighted grenade launcher ownership, which he effectively did, you just watch. You just wait and see.
There has never been a more important election than the 2012 presidential election. We run the profound risk of having Barack Hussein Obama take from us our precious God-given right to carry and conceal grenade launchers.
Tell me that's outside the realm of possibility. Tim from L.A. says, how can Fat Tony Scalia make a statement? The Second Amendment may apply to RPGs. Well, he can, but his comments cannot be law under Article 3, Section 1 through 3 of the Constitution. But see, that's the thing. This is an ethical problem for Fat Tony, and Fat Tony has no ethics because there is no one there who actually ensures the ethical conduct of a member of the Supreme Court. The only way to deal with an ethical breach by a member of the Supreme Court is impeachment, which begins in the House of Representatives like any other does, and ain't none of Boehner's majority ever. I mean, if they caught him stomping kittens outside the Supreme Court, ain't no member of John Boehner's majority ever going to institute impeachment proceedings against Fat Tony Scalia. We clear? Dr. John, fundraising letters. Yeah, they're like fresh peaches. Zero shelf life. Bastards. Well, they couldn't wait because they want the money.
They want the money.
They really, really do. Thanks very kindly for our initial contribution this evening. That gets us another step down the road toward where we need to be. It is much appreciated. We just went from 10% to 11%. Thank you. But there's that and ever so much more. Like I said, in about 26 minutes, we'll be hearing from Dr. Bill O'Brien. Talk a little bit about PRISM and about things that are coming up. But whether it's the NRA or the latest massacre, especially when perpetrated by a skinhead proto-Nazi, neo-Nazi, Ameri-Nazi, whatever you want to call them, member of a band. End Apathy. Wasn't that the name of the band? One of the bands was also called Definite Hate. Down in South Carolina, Stan, in 2007, Wade Michael Page's band played under a giant swastika flag bearing the face of none other than Adolf Hitler in South Carolina, Stan. He started his band End Apathy because, as he said, quote, the value of human life has been degraded by being submissive to tyranny and hypocrisy that we are subjugated to. Sane enough to buy a gun, though. Remember. No, the value. It didn't anybody devalue the human life except this murderous punk. Wonder if anybody ever looks around to see if maybe he was a member of the, I don't know, National Rifle Association. Just asking. The history that I've been listening to for the past couple of days, and have always enjoyed listening to via the Prism series, serves as a sort of reminder that every time I think that we live in a very, very dangerous and squirrely time in America, that I would do well to recall that there has never been a time in America that was not dangerous and squirrely. It just feels more like it now because we're in it. Take, for instance, a teabagger group by the name of the Northeast Pennsylvania Spirit of 1776. They've been sending around an email with pictures of George Washington and Patrick Henry and little Jimmy Madison and Thomas Jefferson and George Mason and James Monroe. Ah, oh, it's funny email they've been sending around. That's a real knee slapper. I don't care who you are. Because it fantasizes about Barack Obama being beaten to a pulp. I'm not kidding. It's how these teabaggers are. And understand something. This is not the fringe of the Republican Party. This is the mainstream of the Republican Party. The I Like Ike Republicans are gone with Ike. The moderate Republicans are gone. The progressive Republicans of the beginnings of the 20th century, yeah, them too, gone. The mainstream of the Republican Party is comprised of weirdos, reactionaries, hate mongers, freaks, and killers. And people who fantasize and masturbate about beating up the President of the United States. From NEPA Spirit of 1776 at AOL.com. Subject: our forefathers express their outrage. When Obama died, George Washington died, past tense? Thought he was still alive. Now they're fantasizing about that too. It's protected speech, right? When Obama died, George Washington met him at the pearly gates. He slapped him across the face and yelled, "How dare you try to destroy the nation I helped conceive!" You know, with that nation-conceiving man womb George had. Patrick Henry approached, punched him in the nose, and shouted, "You wanted to end our liberties, but you failed!" James Madison followed, kicking him in the groin. He was too short to do that. Come on, let's have a little historical accuracy here. He couldn't have kicked him in the ankle. He was practically a Keebler elf. James Madison followed, kicking him in the groin, and said, "This is why I allowed our government to provide for the common defense." Thomas Jefferson was next, beat Obama with a long cane, and snarled, "It was evil men like you inspired me to write the Declaration of Independence. Jesus, and all this time I thought it was a German-speaking king of England." Silly me. The beatings and thrashings continued as George Mason, James Monroe, and 66 other early Americans unleashed their anger on the radical socialist leader. As Obama lay bleeding and in pain, an angel appeared. Obama wept and said, "This is not what you promised me." The angel replied, "I told you there would be 72 Virginians waiting for you in heaven. What did you think I said? You really need to listen when someone's trying to tell you something." Howl, 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 howl.
all, oh man, ain't that funny? I tell you what, that's some kind of funny. I mean, you can't buy a comedy like that. Now, Dr. John's right, though. He said, wait. Using founder, read slaveholder imagery, and talking about Obama being physically beaten? But I thought the Tea Party wasn't racist. Right. Yeah, because they're not. That's just a joke. And you know what? It wasn't a joke about beating the president or nothing. The Northeast Pennsylvania Tea Party teabagging patriots 1776, oh-blah-dee-oh-blah-da, were contacted. And they said, no, it's just a little funny we sent around because it plays on the fact that he might be a Muslim. Oh, well, okay, might be a Muslim. That's a good reason for beating somebody. Guess what? A bunch of people just got gunned down in Wisconsin because some ignorant freaking Nazi thought that because they wore turbans, those Sikhs were Muslims too. Jesus. And no, that is not a fringe of the Republican Party. That is the mainstream of so-called conservatism in America today. Are we clear? That's mainstream Republicanism, baby! Those are the ones that are going to run, not walk, run to the polls in November to get that one out of our White House. Right? Yeah. Jesus. I can't even... Really? Put that out at the same time that a bunch of people who were misidentified... by a hate monger as Muslim and gunned down? Oh, we just thought it was funny because people think he might be a Muslim. Shoot. And then there's this. There's this. I gotta admit, I've not spent a lot of time watching the Olympics. Some people like them. I'm waiting for football season. You know, because I'm a Philistine. But bless her heart, little, and I mean little Gabby Woods. I mean Gabby Douglas, I'm sorry. Where'd I get Woods? Radio Rwanda has declared that Gabby Douglas is not sufficiently patriotic. You know, usually when a young woman wins the gold medal in gymnastics for the United States of America, we can't wait to get her home, put her picture on the Wheaties box, get her on all the TV shows, and talk about... Right. What did Gabby Douglas get? Gabby Douglas got the recently reconstructed face of Bob Costas, declaring after she won that, well, maybe a number of young African-American girls will be interested in gymnastics now. We'll be back right after this. At which point they cut away, as you know by now, to a promo of a monkey doing gymnastics. Really? They really did that? No, of course NBC did. It was entirely accidental. You know, except for maybe somebody down in the tape room. Yeah, that's funny. I thought you would. No, they did that. And if that wasn't enough, then Radio Rwanda got busy. Jeez. She won the gold medal in gymnastics and beat out every other gymnast in the world. And she is a magnificent young thing. An athlete of tender years and tremendous courage and tremendous spirit and tremendous drive and tremendous determination. And yes, she's a friend of Jeebus. She thanked Jeebus for helping her on the balance beam or the vault or the floor exercise or whatever. Because, you know, Jeebus was, 15 people starved to death in Somalia today, but, you know, I had to take care of that kid and get right in the Olympics. But I'm putting that aside for this. The paranoia at Radio Rwanda has risen to epic proportions. I offer you this clip. It has to be heard to be believed. This is from August 3rd.
There was a proud moment at the Olympics yesterday when 16-year-old Gabby Douglas won a gold medal in gymnastics. The crowd went wild with cheers. Though, we're not hearing the chants of USA. USA! That we've heard in some Olympics gone by. And some folks have noticed that American athletes' uniforms don't carry the stars and stripes look as much as they have in past years. The famous flag-styled outfits worn in years past replaced with yellow shirts, gray tracksuits, pink leotards. So how do we show our patriotism?
Pink leotards? Everybody? I got to thank them burly man weightlifters. Well, never mind.
Isn't at the games. David Webb is the host of the David Webb Show on Sirius XM Patriot. He's also the co-founder of Tea Party 365. Hi, David.
How you doing?
So, you know, Gabby had that great moment. Everybody was so excited, mm-hmm. and she's in hot pink. And that's her prerogative, but there were,
it
you know.
It is, and gymnasts also adjust their uniforms within boundaries sometimes. But look, here we go.
What? And gymnasts sometimes adjust their uniforms within boundaries. What the does that mean? Please? Anybody? Help?
Yeah. I'm proud to be an American. I was around in 1980. Matter of fact, I went to school with the younger Ruzioni brother, the Miracle on Ice. What's wrong with showing pride? What we're seeing is this kind of...
Well, dang, David, she done thank Jeebus and everything.
Soft, anti-American feeling that Americans can't show our exceptionalism. And
this sad freak just called this... little teenage girl, un-American. Soft un-Americanism.
Now, don't anybody think, Bob, you took it out of context. Let's just get
all plumb covered up in context. What do you say?
Here we go. I'm proud to be an American. I was around in 1980. Matter of fact, I went to school with the younger Ruzioni brother, the Miracle on Ice. What's wrong with showing pride? What we're seeing is this kind of soft anti-American feeling that Americans can't show our exceptionalism. And frankly, if they are offended about our show and our exceptionalism, then they have that right and I don't care. And
they who? Who has said that they were, did I miss the memo about, Americans better not wear none of that red, white, and blue? Because I think there were some people in red, white, and blue. I mean, can we have a little media analysis moment here? How deadly dull was it over to the Radio Rwanda Fox studios that they had to kill 4 minutes and 45 seconds with this goober accusing a little teenage gold medal winning gymnast from the United States of America who happened to have, you know, dark skin, of being un-American. Soft un-Americanism. Who's the booking agent? Who's the booker?
No, not the stuff you pick out of your nose. The booker. Who's the booker at Radio Rwanda Fox who got this freak on there to verbally assault a little girl? And she is a little girl.
That's
well,
a fact.
It's interesting. I mean, in terms of what's behind it, the fact that we're not as vociferous as we once were about shouting USA and draping ourselves in the flag. David Serrata wrote an article for Salon. He has a theory, and that is that back in the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles, that we were so filled with national pride and people were covering themselves in the flag and they were chanting that, in fact, the president of the IOC complained that it was making the other countries feel uncomfortable, and so now we've tamped it down. Do you
Right, because it took 28 years for that memo to circulate. 84, 94, 2004. Yeah, 28 years. For heaven's sakes. And, of course, she blames it on David Serrata. Liberals!
No, I don't. And frankly, why should we? Every country has the right to cheer for their team. I've been to English soccer matches, and I'm sure that the English men and women are out there cheering loudly in the pubs and having a great time at the stadium. And they should. Spain for their team, the Greeks for their team, any country. But America is America, and we are a very nationalistic nation. But we've also lost over time that jingoistic feeling. You know, the national anthem, we sing it at baseball.
One, that wrapping in the flag business, now this is just my personal experience with a father who happened to be a World War II veteran. When he saw people wrapping themselves in Old Glory, he was disgusted. It's not a cape, he would say. It's our flag. But Fox apparently wants that. And jingo? We've lost that jingoistic feeling? John Fox, you out there? I feel a parody coming on. You've lost that jingo feeling. No, that's the end of singing for this evening. We've lost that jingoistic feeling. Well, I'm just checking here. Jingoism is known as is also known as belligerent nationalism. Belligerent. Belligerent, of course, coming from the Latin root word meaning war. Belligerent nationalism. Extreme patriotism in the form of aggressive foreign policy. In practice, it is a country's advocation of the use of threats or actual force against other countries in order to safeguard what it perceives to be its national interests. Colloquially, it refers to excessive bias in judging one's own country as superior to others. I wonder if the right-wing freak David Webb has... I wonder if he's aware that... The phrase was invented in Great Britain. Oh, no. It apparently comes from a song sung in British pubs and music halls around the time of the Russo-Turkish War between 1877 and 1878. A song by G.H. McDermott, the singer, and G.W. Hunt, the songwriter. We don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do... We've got the ships, we've got the men, we've got the money, too. We fought the bear before, and while we're Britain's true, the Russians shall not have Constantinople. Because I guess Constantinople's like is one of those words like orange, and there's just nothing that rhymes with it. Lost that jingoistic feeling. What a sick bunch. Webb,
is proud to be an American. And by implication, of course, inferring that little Gabby Douglas is not. Right, sickening, you know? Right, sickening. Well, I immediately thought of this when I heard right-wing patriot American loving not lost that jingoistic feeling, David Webb. Let it not be said that progressive radio is without that jingoistic feeling. Play it, Carlos. America's listener-supported liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid. And yes, this is The Horn. We'll be right back.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Yeah, I admit, I was a little anxious. A couple of emails rolling in. Dr. John, he says, under the subject line, Northeast Pennsylvania. You know, I did a whole two-summer excavation and wrote a dissertation about a black family that settled in Northeast Pennsylvania. The patriarch was enslaved, fought in the Revolution, got his freedom, and homesteaded in Susquehanna County. This sickens me. Yeah, as it should. But this is what we can expect from the mainstream of the Republican Party. Jim writing in, he said, uniforms BS. What do they want? Black uniforms with caps bearing the death's heads with a cap device? Dr. Goebbels and Himmler would be proud. Well, considering that Fox News Radio Rwanda works out of their playbook, yeah, Jim, I suspect you're right. They would be proud. But I want to take a little time now. As promised, I have on the line with me none other than Dr. Bill O'Brien. Many of you who have long been listeners to The Horn remember Dr. Bill's show from years past. And let's bring Dr. Bill on and talk about what the future may hold. Talk a little bit about PRISM, and this whole idea of making America's history a little more accessible to everyone. Dr. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am, Bob.
Wow, it's great to have you on air. I mean, we've been hanging out a little bit the last couple of days.
We've been spending a lot of time together, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. But it's nice to have this conversation with the rest of the Horn family.
Great.
You have put a ton of work in, every summer and everything that goes with PRISM into making this all work. Do you think we're making a difference, do you think you're making a difference?
Bob, I to be honest with you, I really do. And you know, you have your downs and you have your disappointments, but things happen. You know, one of the things that I was sharing with the teachers on the first day, and I really mean this, is that one of the more positive things about this PRISM program is the technology that you and your folks have brought to the program. The result of it is that rather than be to have a group of teachers contained within the four walls of a room, we've been able to basically break through those walls with broadcasts on the horn and the use of the internet. And we have people who have been tuning in to our program that we never even envisioned when the program was first conceived. I never even thought of this. And the result is that it is so significant that it has really altered the entire outlook of the program to the point that I think we have pretty well zeroed in on a way to keep the ball rolling, so to speak, even after this year when the grant funding ends. And in the process, and again, it's been a weeding out process. We've lost a lot of teachers, but for very legitimate reasons. We had one teacher, a good friend in Mercer County, who had a stroke last spring and was forced to withdraw from the program. He isn't even working anymore. We've had and our teachers are age where they, many of them are experiencing parents that need attention and more care. One of our best participants, who's a middle school teacher, her husband passed away last year, but he was sick with cancer for a couple of years, and we lost her. And so we've lost some people for very, very legitimate reasons, and very honestly, we've lost some teachers for reasons that I don't think are very academically legitimate. They may be legitimate from their point of view, but a lot of them were in there for credits and income and that's fine. I mean, that's fine. But the fact of the matter is what we have left now is a group of teachers that probably are the best of the best. And the result is that, trying to basically challenge them, and at the same time develop programming that really rewards the interest of people outside the classroom, the people who are tuning in on the horn and watching these programs live, and have been listening to the chat sessions that we've been running on weekends all year long, and we're going to continue to do it this year. We've been able to build interest way beyond the confines of southern West Virginia. And it has positives in a number of different ways. For me, one of the more positive things is it's allowing people outside the area to get an idea as to what some of our teachers are doing. In fact, very honestly, one of our presenters last night and this morning, Bob Bliss from the University of Missouri, Bob told them, and he told me at dinner the night before, that he goes back to St. Louis and shares with people in Missouri the fact that education really ain't dead, especially in West Virginia, even though many people think it is, that there are a group of teachers here doing unbelievable things. And that's kind of exciting because, you know, we all know that people have a very, very negative attitude about education in our public schools anyway, and more specifically what happens in West Virginia schools. And the point is these teachers are really basically putting the pressure on in areas where it's needed. They're challenging students in ways. I had one of the teachers that we've got share with me during break yesterday, and actually had tears running down her face when she told me. She said, I can't tell you what my kids, she teaches sixth graders, and she said, I can't tell you what my kids are doing with these DBQs. I never dreamed. She said, I'm not sure my performance is meeting the standards that you wanted, but I can tell you what's happening in my classroom is something I never even dreamed about. My kids are just absolutely flying. And she said, last year, for the first time, we were able to take them to Washington, and they actually went to the Smithsonian. They actually got to see the Declaration of Independence after all we had done about it, and she said those kids were just busting. They were so excited about actually seeing the real documents, and she said these are kids that never got excited in the classroom ever before in their whole lives. And so that's what we're talking about. And I think that, so in that sense, the answer to your question is, yeah, I think we're making a difference. It's not a big enough one, maybe, but we're making one.
Well, I would sure feel good about any, well, beyond feeling good, I wish my own children had had some of these teachers that have stuck with it, because there's no doubt that they're making a difference. They're making history come alive, because Bill, you've made history come alive for them. The people that over the last 3 years now that I've seen come in and talk, you know, it's a great crime to make history a boring thing for a child.
Yeah.
And what you've done is you've brought people in who have absolutely brought it to life and made it realistic, made the past a very part of a very real present for these teachers, and by extension for their students. You know, I think about the energy that Tom Tierney,
yeah,
has brought to the Prism Summer Academy. I think about the vast storehouse of knowledge. When you listen to John Kaminsky, it sounds like he just left James Madison's house about a half an hour before.
He told us he lives in the 18th century, and he really does.
You know what? I'm glad that there are people who do.
Oh, God, I'm glad too.
Carson Holloway was simply magnificent this afternoon and this morning. And, of course, Bob Bliss, Dr. Bliss, from Dean Bliss, let me get that right, from University of Missouri, St. Louis, with his observations on the origins of rights in Great Britain. Yeah, with all of that context, you can't help but view the present somewhat differently, don't you think? I mean, we exist less in a vacuum, don't we?
Oh my God, yes. You know, I told Bob Bliss this, that the presentation he did last night was, he basically thought it was too basic. And I said, my God, it was fabulous. It's exactly what everybody needed. Where did these rights come from? How did they originate? And one of the questions I asked him last night is, how do we get from where you are, which is in colonial America, how do we get to the point where Jefferson could say that these rights are set, you know, that these rights are unalienable, and that what he's spewing is self-evident truth? And basically he talked about the fact that the mother country used these rights primarily as incentives to get people to come here. And ultimately, in colony after colony, it worked to the point that by the time 1776 came, people were so used to these rights that to them they were unalienable. They had always been there. They ought to be there. Every person who's alive ought to have these rights. And that's basically what Jefferson said in the Declaration. And from then on, and here we go. From that, you know, once you pick it up there, it all begins to make sense. And his basic premise was, and Bob, by the way, for your listeners, Bob Bliss taught at Lancaster University in Northern England for 27 years. He and I went to graduate school together, and then he got a job in England, and I didn't see him for years until he came back to the States in the mid-90s and went to University of Missouri in St. Louis, and he's been there now. I was surprised that he's been there this long. He's been there 15 years. He's been back from England. But he has a perspective. I mean, he taught American studies to British college students. And basically, he brings back here a perspective for our teachers on early American history and on colonial history that is absolutely, you can't get it anywhere else. I mean, he's been over there. He's probably one of the best authorities I know on British history. He was telling us last night, my wife and I, that he's all kind of excited. He said, I've got to tell you, I've been kindled. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I did a pamphlet a number of years ago when I was at Lancaster. And he said, very honestly, we tried to do it to raise money because our funding was way down and we had to do something. We had a meeting of the American Studies Department, and we decided to put together a number of pamphlets that were short. They were 10,000 words or less. They were 50 to 60 page pamphlets on topics that happened to be our research strengths. And then what we did was make them available to incoming freshmen at Oxford and Cambridge and other universities around Great Britain. And the result was they were able to generate more than $100,000 of income for Lancaster, for the History Department and for the American Studies program as a result. And out of that, by the time Bob left there after 27 years, Lancaster was ranked, as he said, among the top 10 universities in Great Britain, seventh in terms of research and eighth in terms of quality of instruction for undergraduate students. And so basically, he was able to go over there to a university that was in trouble and bring it back. And he brings that perspective here, and his expertise is in colonial America. And what he did, which was so basic and so simple, he said the easiest way, I kept thinking and thinking and thinking. I drove all the way in here and trying to think, what's the best way to present this to the teachers? And what he did is he said, I'll take them back to London, to England, in 1600, and I'll basically tell them what rights the English people in 1600s did not have. And he listed them, about a dozen of them. And of course, they're all rights that we take for granted: free speech, religious freedom, all of it, government accountability, the accountability of elected representatives, all of these things. And then he talked about the only way they could get people to relocate to the New World was to basically offer them rights that they didn't have in the mother country. And so basically being able to access land and possibly own your own piece of land by going over there, for many people who had nothing and nothing to look forward to, it was a good deal. And so ultimately that's the way, in large part, that Britain populated its North American colonies. And it worked to the point that these rights to the next generation and the generation after that in colonial America were so common and so popular, and people became so used to them that in their mind they were unalienable, so that when Jefferson basically drafted the Declaration in 1776, he could say on good authority that these rights are, that these are self-evident truths. And I thought it was fantastic.
Well, it absolutely was. And then this morning's discussion of the Crèvecoeur's "What is an American?"
Yeah, "What is an American?"
It was simply amazing. And this is a shameless pitch for people to go to go over to Prism's Ustream site and watch this morning's video.
Yeah,
because everybody likes to talk about de Tocqueville, but there's other stuff out there, and this is part of it. A fascinating, almost panegyric on the beauties of life in the farming country of New York.
Right, and just and some of it is, I'm sure, and that's what we talked about this morning. Some of it is what he saw. We're absolutely positive that some of it was what he wishes he saw. Much of it was what he wishes Europe would pick up on and adopt. Basically, what he was doing was sending a message back to Europe and saying, hey, basically, it's possible. All the things we'd ever thought were possible are happening here in the New World. I mean, God, is that fantastic or what? Talk about exceptionalism. I guess that's a form of it.
Well, indeed it is. And it's a far cry from the exceptionalism of criticizing a little teenage girl because she's not wearing the right leotard.
Oh, God, yeah, I know about that with Gabby, yeah. It's just unbelievable. I have to believe some of this is just a 24-hour news cycle. People are just looking for things. It's unbelievable.
Well, I think a lot of it can be chalked up to that, but I've gotten to the point where I don't believe there are any accidents at Fox News.
I think
it's all quite deliberate. Well, you're getting some notes in. Texas Betsy, of course, who's been following Prism for the 3 years it's been on the horn, is saying that, you know, the whole thing needs to be packaged and accessible to teachers outside the program. Reading lists, videos, maybe even the pretests too. She'd love to see that out there. And of course, a lot of that is and has been under construction. Then, meanwhile, a note has come in from Jim, and my computer is not cooperating with me right now, or I would read Jim's note to you. But he said, "Better to light a candle than to curse the darkness of ignorance," and offered kudos to you, Dr. Bill. Let's take just a moment here, though, and talk about where we go from here. You know, you talked about the grant wrapping up.
Right.
Does that mean that this is the end of everything?
Oh, no. And one of the things that, you know, I'm going to do an annual performance review for the Department of Education in September. It's due the 1st of October in Washington. And one of the things that I'm going to have to explain is the attrition of teachers. I mean, I've got to explain. You know, we've lost the teachers for a number of reasons, some of them good for good reasons, some of them for not good reasons. But the part of the program which is this part, which is the interactive part and the access through the internet and through the horn, so that we have so many people able to participate in portions of, if not the entire program, and the fact that this particular audience has been growing and becoming more a part of the process throughout this last, you know, better than a year, gave me an idea. And basically, I am not, and Bob, you know this, but other people don't, so I'll say it straight up. I'll be as honest as I can be. I am probably the least technology literate person. In other words, I'm way out of my time, but at the right time in history, I'd have been a Luddite. You know, it totally amazes. I mean, this stuff just totally blows me away. I get all irritated. Whenever I go to a screen and it gives me squares and tells me to write within the lines and then jump from spot to spot and not only basically say what I'm supposed to say, but say it in the right place, in the right order, I just go out of my mind. I get so flustered, that I have trouble doing, I can't think. And anyway, bottom line is, I'm not technologically savvy in any stretch. What I am, and to tell you the truth, I feel a little bit good about this, because a lot of my colleagues who have reached the numbers of years in education that I've reached, don't subscribe to this, and I do, and I feel a little bit good about it. While I don't know how to do this stuff, I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of years realizing that technology, the internet, and all that the internet can do, not only what we know it can do now, but what our instincts tells us it's going to be able to do in the future, suggests to me that there's a revolution possible in education, not only in terms of the numbers of people we can reach, but also the quality of product that we can deliver. And part of, you know, one of the biggest things that I've learned over the years in education is that the education doesn't happen from the person that's delivering the information. The education is what happens to the people who receive the information. In other words, what the process of actually receiving the information and engaging it is really where the education happens. And once you realize that, then you begin to realize that technology offers tremendous opportunities if you can package the information in the right way in order to generate the right the proper activities on the other end. What I'm suggesting is that technology offers the opportunity for people to do things that they're not even aware that are even possible now, but it's clear that technology will make them possible in the future. in southern West Virginia, for example, I mean, I see the problems with the economy and coal and people being locked into the mentality of coal and the decline in jobs and the demise of hope and all of these other things. And I have realized more and more and more that technology for West Virginia and West Virginia's future is the answer. And to me, what that means is they don't need to know what I can teach them about computers, for example, because I can't teach them anything. But the reality is they don't even know what you need to know about what you teach them about computers, and you know a hell of a lot. But what they have to do is master everything that's available in order so that they can begin to envision where we can go from here. In other words, in order to develop new things that technology is going to enable us to do, they've got to master where we already are. And so many people, so many students come into a class, I don't care if it's a high school class or a middle school class or an elementary class or a college class. They come in and their goal is to learn, to know what the teacher knows. The reality is the real revolution is going to happen when people decide that they want to know what the teacher knows so they can take it to the next step. The teacher can't do it because if he could or she could, they wouldn't be teaching. They'd be out there doing it. So ultimately, it's the next step that is the key one. And what that means is the whole approach to education has to change. What we're after, this whole idea of testing and testing and measuring what people know and assuming that our best brains and our best minds become visible because of what they know. Our best minds become visible for what they envision for the future and where they can take us. And once West Virginians begin to grasp that, economic development and all the things that go with it, jobs and quality of life and quality of education and everything else will go along with it and will improve. And that's what we're on the cusp of with this program, I believe. And so, in a sense, the most important part of PRISM to me is not where we've been and what we've done, but what we've learned from what we've been able to do. You and I have talked in the last couple of days about things that we can do. For example, just in response to the email you mentioned earlier, one of the things we talked about once we get this academic year underway is to sit down and pull together the materials that we've been able to generate so far and make them available to much, much larger numbers of people. Put together a website that is much more user friendly. And I'm going to have to do a lot of that. I'm going to have to basically write little summaries in order to tell people who tune in to that website, you know, this is what you can grasp out of this resource. This is what you can get out of that resource, et cetera, so that people can use and take advantage of what we've already done. And so, in a sense, that means we need to take where we are and go the next step. And I believe we're going to be able to do that. I'm excited and intimidated at the same time. But Concord University here in southern West Virginia has given me the opportunity to do something at the end of my academic career that I dreamed about. And the president, to his credit, asked me last spring, you know, what's in your future? What would you like to do? You got a couple of years left, really productive years. What would you like your legacy to be? And I told him, I said, in order to do what I want to do, I think I'm probably going to have to retire. And he said, well, what is it? And I told him, and I said, you know, we've been able to pull together some of the best people in terms of presenters and in terms of classroom teachers. We've been able to pull in some of the top resources. We've got a collection of resources that we've been able to make available through this grant that are available here on the internet. They're digitally available to anybody who wants to and can access them. John Kaminsky's project. Every letter, every document, every law, every debate, every public debate, every private letter, journal entries, handbills, every source out of the 18th century related to the Constitution of the United States and its ratification in each of the 13 original states is available digitally to anybody that wants to go after them. One of the things we've been able to do is give our teachers access to those resources. What I wanted to do is give the population at large access to those resources, because Congress's number one priority in making these resources available on the Internet, and they basically charge the University of Virginia with this, you know, with this responsibility, is to come up with a way to make these primary resources about America's founding and basically the beginnings of this nation available to as many people as possible. But the challenge for educators is to make them available in ways which cause people to want to look at them and want to use them and want to draw from them. Basically, what I suggested is that Senator Byrd, in the last years of his life, made it very clear that ignorance about the U.S. Constitution and all that it means in people's day-to-day lives is almost non-existent in this society. That's why when he was in the Senate, he made available the kind of money that made it possible for a grant like PRISM. What I basically envision and what I told the president at Concord is what we need is a center for the study of the presidency, but not a center that creates a place for professional historians to come and do primary research and jaw back and forth amongst themselves and just talk amongst themselves about the details and the innards of these sources. What we need to do is put together a center whose number one priority is to communicate with the general public through the Internet so that anybody basically can get on and can look at discussion, can participate in, listen to and participate in discussions, can interact with the people who are the real authorities on this stuff, who can look at the primary documents, the primary papers of Madison and Jefferson and Hamilton and all the rest of them, and can basically begin to understand for themselves the kinds of choices and the kinds of decisions that these folks, that these people had to make. Once they do that, We're talking about the beginnings of an educated electorate. And one of the things that excites me is the fact that, and we've been talking, and you've been all evening tonight talking about Fox News. The reason that Fox News is able to do what they do, and some of the screamers on the other side as well, is basically they've taken on the task of basically trying to claim ownership of the founders by basically spewing out what they believe, what they want to believe, and basically attributing it to the founders, when in fact much of what they're saying is not true, is not valid, etc. The problem is that the general population out there has no way of knowing that, because they've never been exposed to the issues. They're not able, most of them, to basically perceive individual agendas when there is one. In other words, they basically don't know the kinds of questions. They're unable to basically separate the good stuff, the substance, from the crap, very honestly.
And because of the fact that something like Fox is one-way communication, Dr. Bill, that means by definition that they're not allowed to challenge Fox's orthodoxy.
No. And ultimately, if you listen to that same thing over and over again, then what they say, whether it's true or not, doesn't matter. And the irony is, when somebody pulls together sources that prove that they were wrong, their basic argument is, well, it was a mistake, but that's not really important. And then they go right on. This happened last week when Romney was speaking in Jerusalem. And ultimately, he was talking about the superiority of the Israeli culture, right in the midst of the Palestinians, and you know, the insult and all of that. And in the process, he was quoting, one of the books that he cited was Jared Diamond's book, on guns, germs, guns, and steel, I think is the name.
Yeah, guns, germs, and steel, yeah, right.
And the role of geography and access to resources and all of these other things. And basically Romney said that Diamond said that geography has nothing to do with it. It's all culture. Well, Diamond came back a couple of days later with an op-ed piece in the New York Times and basically said the one thing that Romney proves is he didn't read my book, because I never said that. And then
I read his book, and I know he never said
Jared
that.
Jared Diamond basically began to lay out exactly what he did say, which is a lot more complex and was a lot more concise. But basically, the argument is that the damage has been done. I mean, you know, that basically this guy had an audience there, and he basically claimed to know something which he didn't know.
And you can't unring a bell.
The opportunity to challenge it.
Right, you can't unring a bell.
No.
Well, I have a question for you, Dr. Bill. Dr. John has written in, and Dr. John has been one who has tuned in just about every time you've gotten near a microphone. He absolutely adores the PRISM series, and I think understands as well as anybody the mission that you've been describing with PRISM. And Dr. John just said, can Dr. Bill comment on the push for all, and this is a fascinating question because it goes to the very heart of what you were talking about yesterday morning on the broadcast. Can Dr. Bill comment on the push for all education to be geared toward job skills? I see that, says Dr. John, as a direct threat toward humanities and social science, but civics and critical analysis are crucial to building good citizens, aren't they?
Oh, man.
Go, yeah, Bill, go.
The answer is yes. But, you know, the irony, and thank you, John. I appreciate everything that you've said and done. And one of the irony here is, and this is something that I've always believed, but I've never been able to get it off the, off the mark, but maybe with this program we're beginning to do it. The irony of ironies is that the humanities and the skills that are necessary to really address the kinds of things we've been talking about are skills that become the kinds of skills that the corporate world and the scientific world needs. You know, the irony is that material, the arts, literature, the arts, history, geography, government, that stuff well taught. And what I mean by well taught is if the material is put together in a way which requires students to do certain things in order to master it, then ultimately in the process they are developing the very skills that are jobs. And I don't mean assembly line factory skills, obviously. What I'm talking about is the ability to think, the ability to make to evaluate options, the ability to judge a number of options. The ability to distinguish between what's valid and what's not valid. The ability to read between the lines and recognize that there's an agenda here that's not being spoken, but it's really driving the whole process. The ability to, Jefferson said in his notes on Virginia, one of the things that students will get from studying history is the ability to recognize duplicity. Even if the person who's being duplicitous is trying to disguise it. Of course, Jefferson's problem was he was assuming all of this could happen in 3 years of elementary education, and the fact of the matter is, youngsters are not sophisticated. It's going to take a lot more than that. But the point is, those kinds of what the educational folks refer to as higher order thinking skills, analysis and the ability to synthesize information, the ability to organize information, the ability to put together argumentative pieces which argue a point of view and basically are able to prove your point rather than just spouting ideology and screaming louder than the people who don't agree with you. All of that stuff is can be addressed in the way we teach what we teach. And Jefferson and Madison and all the rest of them, basically, the one thing they all agree on, even Hamilton, agreed that the only way that popular Republican government could last is if you put your reliance not on government, but on the people, on the abilities of the people to hold government accountable. And in order to do that, they need to know what's going on. And in order to know what's going on, they basically have to be taught how to evaluate what's going on and be able to recognize and make these kinds of judgments and these kinds of decisions. When they do that, you know, I'm going to say Thursday night is in some of my remarks about American exceptionalism, one of the things I want to emphasize is that I believe in American exceptionalism, but it has nothing to do with the exceptionalism that we hear thrown around all the time. I believe that American society is the first society in the history of man which basically said, we are going to take the Sermon on the Mount and basically give it wheels. We are going to basically take the idea of educating everybody and giving everybody the skills they need and the support they need to take them as far as whatever they've got internally can take them. And a society that will recognize that if everybody does that, everybody is worthy and everybody basically is, I believe, is fulfilling what God meant when he gave people minds. There's no way in the world that we have a mind and God would intend that we not use it. And I think that that's what Jefferson was talking about. I know that's what John Adams was talking about. And basically that's what we're talking about here. And my point is that when you get people who think like that and can do like that and know how to ask questions and know what questions to ask and ultimately don't fall for the obvious and, you know, don't go for the first option and fall for the obvious, then ultimately what you got is the kind of society and the kinds of people who have the education that have the job skills that corporations are looking for and everything else. People that can make decisions, people that can take responsibility, people that can be held accountable for assignments that they're given, people that can produce, and people that are rewarded for what they know and what they can do, not who they know.
And people who can craft an argument or a theory and back it up.
Yes.
Because, you know, to be a corporate robot and simply somebody somewhere is doing some thinking. But it's not happening. The thinking's being done I don't know, maybe it's bad thinking, Dr. Bill.
Decisions are being made at some point, you know, somewhere. And I just think that, you know, our whole education system is focused on the idea of getting rid of the people that we don't feel are capable of making the kinds of decisions that have to be made. The problem is we never get, you know, and the idea is once we get rid of all those who aren't qualified, we can basically focus on the education of the few who are. The United States, America is slipping further and further behind the world because never have we basically decided to follow through on our commitment to give everybody an equal shot. And if you're going to do that, then you basically got to begin by saying, everybody can learn, and my job is to teach everybody here as much as they can handle. Not waste your time trying to eliminate and say so-and-so can't do this. And I'm so, all my life I've been hearing instructors say, if somebody at the lower level would give me students, you know, would teach students that I get, I could teach. But unfortunately, I have to teach stuff that they should have known when I get them. And that, I mean, middle school teachers say that about elementary school teachers, high school teachers about middle school teachers, college instructors about high school teachers, and on and on. Everybody's basically kicking the ball back to the previous level. And the point is we've got to stop that.
And that I think brings us, and Lord, we could touch on things that have already been examined just in the beginning of this Prism Summer Academy, the idea of people being motivated by their ideologies and beliefs or being motivated by their self-interest. That was huge yesterday morning.
Uh-huh.
But to go forward then, talking about reaching out, I have alluded to this from time to time, but we may as well just get it out in the open, Dr. Bill.
Okay, Bob.
You see a value in extending these examinations of the founding and of the Constitution into something that can be done on a daily basis. Is that right?
Right. We've talked, you know, God, we've talked about putting together an opportunity, and we're going to do it on the Horn, to do a program, a daily program, and base it on the Constitution. And obviously not just on the on you know what's written in the Constitution, but the implications of it for people who live under it, and basically have to understand it. And that gets into it gets into an awful lot. I mean, it gets into the role of the court. It gets into what Congress is doing or not doing. It gets into the issue of rights. It gets into the issues of responsibility, the issues of citizenship, all of it. And so basically what I've been able to and what the president of Concord has given me the opportunity to do is he has approved the creation of a Center for the Study of the Constitution of the United States. We're calling it the Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. And I'm to spend this year going to different places for corporate funding and trying to raise the kind of money that will create an endowment which will perpetuate this center long after I go. Part of that is that we will begin a two-hour program on the Constitution, on the Horn. We talked about it in the last couple of days, about right after Labor Day. And I guess the time we're talking about, Bob, is 4 to 6 in the evening, just before you come on.
Right, right.
And I don't know whether that's going to allow me to benefit from the people that are used to listening to you. Maybe I ought to think that it's going to allow you to benefit from the people who listen to me. But
there
anyway,
we go.
Whatever. But we're going to do it, and we're going to give it a try. And you know, a lot of it will be the delivery of information, but a lot of it is going to be call-in. A lot of it is going to be opinion. We want people to begin to think about some of the things rather than just listening to people who are telling them what to think. We want to basically give them some basis on which to begin to think that there might be alternatives, there might be other ways. We've got a situation here in southern West Virginia, which is a tremendous opportunity. I really don't believe that a lot of folks in the region are fully aware of what the full ramifications of this are, but the Boy Scouts of America have decided to hold their jamboree beginning next summer here in southern West Virginia in Fayette County. So we're going to have thousands of young people from all over the country coming in here in the summers, and what we're talking about is generating an education product. One of the things that Boy Scouts have to do is earn merit badges, and one of the things they have to do, one of the areas of merit badge, securing merit badges for Scouts and Eagle Scouts especially, is in the area of citizenship. And so what we've done is we've identified 7 areas that are related to citizenship, and we've turned our teachers in the prison program during this summer academy loose on developing instructional models that they'll be able to use in citizenship education this coming year in their own classes. But more than that, these teachers will be educational consultants for educational programs that the Boy Scouts of America will have access to as well. And these programs are going to be based on the kinds of things that we've been doing in prisons. I'm just thrilled. I mean, you know, if it doesn't work, it's going to be a noble effort.
I can't help but think that it will work, though. This is an amazing opportunity. You know, Dr. John just wrote in and he said, "I'm so incredibly excited about this program. You'll have a dedicated listener and a promoter here." On the other hand, in our chat room, I just got a note from Onward to Dystopia. And he said, "There's one problem, Bob. Most Fox so-called news viewers have the reading comprehension level of a third grader." And my thought on that, Bill, is that doesn't this plan sort of imagine a reinvention of civic responsibility? I mean, for instance, if we talk about the Fox demographic, the young end of the Fox viewing spectrum is 56 years old.
Uh-huh.
we have to start. There are some people that just, and I hate to say this, but I think it's true, Bill. There are some folks that you have to say, you know, we may not reach them. But by focusing on a younger demographic, by focusing on young people, then when we do that, we send them back into their own classrooms asking questions and make it more difficult to simply for them to simply be taught at, if I understand your operative philosophy correctly.
Right, right. One of the things that, just a small kind of an example of this from this morning, you were talking earlier about Bob Bliss's, what is this person, what is this man we call an American, to Krevkor's piece. And we were focusing on a paragraph this morning that talked about the interaction of the different religions in colonial, in America, during the Krevkor's, visit to New York. And he was talking about German Lutherans, and he was talking about Quakers, and he was talking about Catholics, and basically what he was saying in his own inimitable way was that every one of these people has their own religious beliefs, but the reality is that we're in a situation here where as long as one of those groups doesn't try to jam what they believe down the throats of their neighbor, as long as they keep religion where it ought to be, we can live together. We can plow our fields, and we can basically harvest our crops, and we can basically get along and help each other build barns and repair leaky roofs and all of this other stuff, and not let any of that other stuff that'll divide us get into it. And you know, the thing that occurred to me during the as we were looking at that paragraph, what he's doing in that short paragraph is defining the whole rationale behind integration of, you know, behind integration, behind the idea of religious diversity, trying to find a way that diverse cultures and diverse religions and people from different national backgrounds and races and religions and everything else can basically live and function and prosper together. We have spent our entire lives defining that for students who sit there and take notes and write it into notebooks and memorize it for tests. The fact of the matter is, if they read that paragraph from de Crevecoeur, they don't even have to be able to read it. If they put it on a Kindle, all they have to do is push the right button, and the Kindle will read it to them. And they can hear it, even if they can't read it. And once you hear it, and once you see it and think about it, you begin to realize that's what the whole idea of cultural diversity means. That's what integration is about. That's what's supposed to happen. That's the rationale behind this. No amount of formal definitions of terms is gonna basically come close to matching the level of understanding. And people who can't read except on the level that you talk about will begin to realize that there's another level to read on, and once they begin to realize what it is, they'll begin to do it.
Wow. So my rather facile dismissal of it, you're not even willing to dismiss them, are you?
No.
And you really can't.
My feeling is, Bob, very honestly, I'm probably the optimist of all time, but my feeling isn't, and has always been, that this stuff is so great that once people begin to realize what's possible, then there's absolutely no limit to what they can do. And what we have to do is we have to get our kids, our youngsters, into this and say, this is what's possible. This is what you can do. You don't have to basically sit there and be, you know, and have truth hammered into your head that's being defined by somebody else who may be, or, you know, outside the classroom could be some sort of a raving lunatic or something. The bottom line is that you know, the ability to read and think. I've always felt that one of the biggest flaws in our whole approach to reading in our schools and you know, we have more and more people at the college level who are teaching reading. And the fact of the matter is,
if you're teaching reading at college,
yes,
it's really not college anymore, is it?
Because people are not taught to read to read analytically. People read words. I mean, they basically, they stand up and they read a sentence or a couple of sentences for the teacher, and they're able to read the words and make it sound, and, but if, that when they sit down, if you ask them what they just read means, they say, I don't know. Because they can't comprehend what they read, but nobody ever asked them to until they get to things like the West test and things, and then they found out that their reading comprehension levels are borderline. And so therefore, in order to basically begin to perform at a post-secondary level, at a college level, people have to go back and relearn to read. And what that means is reading critically, reading analytically, so-called reading between the lines, not falling for the obvious, recognizing that people have agendas and people say things and a lot of times they're trying to work it out in their own mind. They want to hear it and see it. They want to get other people's reaction to it. So even though they say it, it's not necessarily what they believe because they really haven't made up their mind yet. And one of the things I've seen, for example, you read Jefferson's a classic example of this. If you read Jefferson's papers and you look through, he'll write about the same subject every couple of, he'll write about the same thing, and then 10 years later he'll write a letter that touches on the same subject, and he's contradicting himself. And you say, this guy is full of crap. He says the exact opposite of what he said 5 years ago. Fact of the matter is, what you begin to realize is this is a guy that's trying to figure it out. He's not a guy that has found truth. He's a guy that's in search of it. And that's really what it's about, is looking for it. The people that claim they've already found it scare the hell out of me.
Well, amen to that. And you've got a question coming in from Betsy, and I'm guessing I know the answer to this. And I think you've alluded to some of it as well, Dr. Bill.
Okay.
Betsy says, please ask Dr. Bill to comment on how this theory or this approach that you've described meshes with two-tiered education, or what I think it was described yesterday as three-tiered education, that 15, 15, 70, 15.
Right.
How this meshes with two-tiered education and tracking. Betsy says, what I see here is that the education of regular kids is different from the education of the gifted.
We've touched on that, haven't we?
significantly yesterday morning.
Yeah. Jefferson touches on it a lot, and basically, I mean, they believed, people see this as heresy, and you got to get beyond this, and that's why during our orientation yesterday, I put this in the teacher's hands weeks ago, but I didn't want to take the chance that they would look it over and see, and see this essay and maybe read it, maybe not read it, maybe skim it or whatever. So basically what I wanted to do during the orientation was force them to read this paragraph by Jefferson when he talked about what we need in this country are two systems of education, one for the leaders and one for the followers. And basically what you do is you pass legislation. This is his bill for general diffusion of knowledge.
Yeah, he really wanted to see this happen.
Yeah. That his argument is you basically teach morality and ethics and good behavior to everybody, and then you basically send everybody home except the brightest, the kids who test the best, and then you send them on to the next level because they've demonstrated ability. And what you're doing is you're gradually weaning out more and more until you get to the cream of the crop. Jefferson uses the phrase, by this process, the boy of best genius is raked from the rubbish annually and educated at public expense. Raked from the rubbish annually. But the irony is...
Hi, I'm Bob, and I'm rubbish.
Get this one. This is the part that gets me. And what he says is, you take this, he says, in this way... 20 boys a year, the boys of best genius in the 20 different regions, the brightest kid in each school, will be pulled from the masses, raked from the rubbish, so to speak. And then he said, you take this 20 and you educate them at the next level. And then the next year you go in and you take, and you get the brightest 10 of those 20. And the 10 top ones go to William and Mary. The others are dismissed. From that group of the people who don't make it to William and Mary, they become the teachers of your public schools.
That was, and when we went over that yesterday morning, I found that, well, there's a million different words. It's elitist,
yeah.
And you hate to talk about Thomas Jefferson and say wrong-headed, but it is.
Yeah.
It is, and of course, you know, it was the best boys, too, which means best white boys.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
At the time. Yeah,
yeah.
Women don't need education.
No. It's poor. It's poor. The children of the poor are the major targets of this. And as he says, during this period, this is when the foundations of future order will be laid at this level. And I was absolutely determined that teachers would have to deal with this.
Because, well, do you think that they see that it's operative in their own world?
Yeah, and that's the point. This really hasn't changed our whole education system. And I was sharing the story yesterday, and when you mentioned the 15 and the 15 and the 70, you know, a good friend of mine here in southern West Virginia, just retired superintendent, and when he used to be superintendent of this county that I'm in, which is Raleigh County, where Beckley is, I used to meet with him a lot, and basically he used to tell me, and he said, you know, our teachers, our schools, we spend most of our time either on the top 15% trying to figure out who, you know, which colleges they can get in and trying to get them into the best colleges. And then we have the 10 to 15% at the bottom end who are your discipline problems and cause all the trouble. The 70% in the middle, we never have time to educate. Those are the kids that don't cause any trouble. They're just there, and we basically take them for granted, and they come in and they go home at the end of the day, day after day after day, and we never have time for them. And he said, you know, as a society, we're costing ourselves, because what we've done is we've developed a system which is focused on educating the top 10 to 15% and eliminating everybody else. And we no longer can do that because the rest of the world is educating everybody.
And we can't, I mean, we cannot afford that as a nation, can we?
No.
I mean, not even from the viewpoint
not.
Of how we compete with the rest of the world. But just as a nation that wishes to do something besides devolve into, to use the title of one of our favorite films around here, an idiocracy, you can't write off 70% of your population.
You can't continue to do it. Because first of all, you can't make the assumption that there's no real talent in that 70%. And the fact of the matter is, if you educate them properly, what I would define as properly, if what you need to do is give them an opportunity to do what they're able to do and to basically support them and basically not find out the skills they don't have, but find out the skills they do have and cultivate them. And as a society, we need to begin to recognize the value of what people can do, not be critical of the things they can't do. I mean, it sounds simple, and obviously it's not, because you go all the way back to Jefferson and Benjamin Rush and the rest of them, and they basically developed a system. They believed that, you know, they really believed that everybody ought to have an equal chance, but the assumption was that in a competitive environment, what wealth and success was the way you identify talent and ability, and that match continued all the way through, and we can't afford to do that. So as a society, we've made a commitment to educate everybody. Our challenge is to educate everybody the same way, because clearly we've done a good job in educating the top 10 to 15%. We have the best colleges and some of the brightest students, and I mean we've led the world for generations in terms of the quality and in terms of you know, the kind of economy we have and the kinds of innovations we've instilled and all of that. But the point is, we've never really recognized the fact that we're losing so much in the process. We can't afford to, I don't think we can afford to continue to lose it. We've got to basically find a way to reach those kids that we haven't really given due time to before.
And okay. God only knows what will come of loosing that untapped, unfounded, and frankly, at some levels, uninterested in talent. You know, I think a lot. There's a very famous short story. Well, they're all famous, but there's a famous piece by Mark Twain called a Brief Account of Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven, Dr. Bill.
Uh-huh.
And in that, he takes some in the form of a rough-hewn character who is a sea captain who has gone on to his reward. He makes his way to heaven and finds out that heaven is nothing like what he had been told it was back on earth in life.
Mm-hmm.
And recounts at one point the story of a barber who is regaled in heaven as being the greatest poet of all time. And he says, "Why, Ferguson, I'm here to tell you, I've seen Shakespeare and Homer stand together and beg simply to touch the hem of that man's robes." And goes on to explain that the man was merely a barber in life, but that the potential he had and the genius that he had was as a poet, but that on earth in life he never got to develop the poet that was inside him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so as you were describing all this, I was thinking about that particular instance. We don't know what untapped talents lie in the children that we largely ignore.
No.
And because of that, we don't know. Do you remember when Dick Cheney, back when he was still operating on his own heart and not somebody else's? Remember when Dick Cheney, it was Don Rumsfeld, that was talking about known knowns and unknown knowns and unknown unknowns?
Yes, I do remember that.
Well, this is actually a real instance of that. We don't know what we're missing.
No.
And the question is, the difference is between the people who don't know what they're not missing and the people who do at least suspect what we're missing. And as long as we continue off down this path where, as Betsy notes, the curricula are geared only to the middle 50%, we're never going to find out, are we?
No. No, it's obviously beyond realistic to think that we can sure begin. And the thing, Bob, is that, you know, the technology makes it possible to reach people that, you know, now the question is, but, you know, the challenge is you don't want to reach them with the same stuff that turned them off before. Basically what we've got to do is take materials and make them come alive. And begin to basically relate it to our system, because our system is basically, we have this whole Scalia idea of originalism and original intent of the founders, and the idea that the system was put together to remain static. And
you know, that just drives me nuts.
Yeah, me too. And the fact of the matter is they did not basically create a system that was supposed to be basically fixed in concrete for all time. Basically, they put together a system that they believed could last and could work for the nation as it progressed, as it moved forward. And ultimately, what that means is it had to be able to adjust. And the strength of the Constitution is its flexibility and the fact that it is able, you know, without having to change it every day. It's put together in a way that gives us the flexibility to apply it to rapidly changing circumstances. And we've got these people out there who basically are trying to make sure that that doesn't happen. And somebody's got to begin to make the case as to the dangers that these people pose. I mean, the idea that you basically stop history and stop time from flowing and basically take a snapshot of where we are now. The people at the top stay at the top. The people at the bottom never get to the top. We'll have a revolution on our hands if we do that. and we should.
Indeed. Another question coming in from Onward to Dystopia, and I know this. I think I know the answer to this as well. And I say that every time I say that, I say that because you and I have been talking for a lot of years now.
Yep.
But the question comes in: how will we deal with David Barton's group, the Wall Builders? Wouldn't they be kind of problematic to our cause? You remember the Wall Builders, the people, Bill, who make up quotes from people like Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and Thomas Jefferson?
Yeah, okay.
Because I remember you actually doing a show on this way back when you and I were both on terrestrial radio.
Oh, yeah. And that's ultimately the challenge of Wikipedia, is that Wikipedia is susceptible to that because anybody can go on there and put anything they want on there. And so ultimately you got to be able, I mean, Wikipedia has tremendous information, but you got to be able to recognize that some of it may not be valid. And the only way that these folks can get away with this kind of thing is basically they're dealing with an audience who's being told what to believe, being told what to think, not taught how to think, and not taught to look for the flaws in this, and not taught, and basically, that's the issue. And the only, the thing that bothers me, I mean, the best example, Bob, of this whole thing is the amount of money that's going into this current presidential campaign. The mere fact that super PACs and corporations are pouring the amount of money in. The fact that money works is because the driving assumption of all of it is that if there was a thinking electorate out there who really knew what the issues were and knew how to basically sift through all of these things and basically arrive at the actual positions and issues and stuff, if this advertising didn't work, they wouldn't do it. And so basically the thing that bothers me more than anything else about the amount of money that's going into our election campaigns is that it's all being driven by the assumption that the vast majority of people who are going to cast ballots have no idea what's going on, and that ultimately all we need to do is spend enough money to be able to tell them what they ought to do louder than the people who try to tell them something else to do.
And the saddest thing, I think, out of that whole sorry process, Bill, is that we are talking about, at best, among the electorate, which, as we understand, is probably going to wind up, as was noted, I think, today, that 15% of the people eligible to vote in the United States will select the next president. That's usually the way it works out.
Right.
What we're seeing is that these, literally this time through, billions of dollars are going to be spent to change the minds or sway the opinion of, inside that already tiny percentage, if you assume that Willard Romney and Barack Obama each have 48%, all that money is going to go to influence 4% of that already minuscule electorate.
Right.
And when that happens, you are very nearly on the verge of having an outright failed system, aren't you?
That's right. That's right. You're exactly right. I mean, it's very obvious that the vast majority of voters are going to be living in states where, if it's not considered to be what the pollsters say is a toss-up state, the campaign is not even going to happen in this state.
Well, I mean, do you harbor any illusions whatsoever that Barack Obama is going to come to West Virginia between now and November? I don't.
No. He's written it off because he can't afford to. He knows it's a waste of time. And so he's written us off, which means that our votes are going to be...
And for that matter, Willard Romney probably doesn't need to do much in the way of campaigning in a place like West Virginia, because he can take that side of the electorate for granted. And I want to go back just for a minute and talk about the Wall Builders question for a second and offer up this observation. What you are talking about in toto here, Dr. Bill, unless I completely misunderstand it, is a full-on assault, for lack of a better word, on the idea of history as dogma. Because outfits like Wall Builders treat history and deliver their phony baloney history to their intended targets as received wisdom, as dogma, as something that is unchallengeable and must be taken at face value and for granted and not challenged. The essence of what you're talking about, however, is an invitation to challenge, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. One of the things, and I don't know whether this is directly applicable to your point, but I think it is. One of the things that I've learned over the years, when you read the sources, the founders, when you read, you know, read their papers and things, one of the things that becomes immediately clear is that they believe that truth is not received. Truth is discovered. That if you read the sermons, for example, of the ministers in the congregational churches in Massachusetts or whatever, what you find is they aren't the Jeremiah type of things you hear now. They're very carefully worded, well put together, thought out pieces, and they are intended to generate thought and reflection and to get people to reflect on things, because the idea is that truth is going to be something that is learned, that is discovered. It's not going to be something that's revealed. And our whole approach has been different than that. And that's what we're talking about. When you talk about history as dogma, you're talking about presenting things from the past that say what you believe as if it was, as you say, dogma. And ultimately what you're asking people to do is not question it, but ultimately to absorb it and accept it and not to challenge it.
And just by way of clarification, because of a comment I just got from Jim, We've focused a lot on the learning of young people, but also tucked into this entire conceptualization, Dr. Bill, is the notion of changing the learning dynamic among those who are already beyond the level of what we would consider to be typical learners, right?
Yes. Yes. And what I mean, over the years I've found that older students, so-called adult students, that when you challenge them, they can deal with this. I mean, they've got their experience and their abilities and all of that thing, and when they bring it to the table, they oftentimes go crazy over this stuff, because it's usually the kind of thing that they've never really been exposed to before. You will change minds, and I really believe that. The center that we're talking about, basically what we're talking about is just throwing things out there and giving people an opportunity to look at things from a different perspective than perhaps they've ever thought about them before. And not to basically, I'm not trying to basically convince people that this is the way to look at it rather than that way. What I'm talking about is the ability to reflect and just encouraging people to reflect on what they believe and contrast it with some things that they hadn't thought about before, and then begin to ultimately do the kinds of intellectual analysis and comparing and contrasting and judging and all the rest of it that ultimately results in actually changing perspectives. Or people may end up believing the same thing, but they'll be a lot more certain as to why what they believe makes sense than they ever were before. It won't be just because somebody that I like to listen to told me that was the way it is.
And just by way of sort of putting a cap on all of this, let's talk a little bit about, first of all, let me throw this out there. I am very much looking forward to the remarks that you're going to be offering to the PRISM Summer Academy Thursday night. We pick back up with the Academy on Thursday morning.
Right.
And on Thursday night, you're going to be offering observations and remarks on that thing which is referred to as and has been expropriated by the right as American exceptionalism.
Right.
As noted earlier, I don't think it has anything to do with gymnastics wear, where you're coming from.
No.
But on Friday morning, and this, and other people are doing this. They're doing this already, but they are not doing this from the same operational philosophy. Thursday morning, we're going to take the next step in what will ultimately be what we hope is routine interaction. We're going to bring in, because these things are going out via video as well as audio, PRISM West Virginia, PRISMWV, is actually a channel at ustream.tv, and we're going to be bringing in our first remote lecturer on Friday, Jeremy Suri.
Right.
And that represents a real step forward for what we've been trying to do for the next for the last couple of years. And this will be it'll be a little white knuckled, I have a feeling, or at least I'll be nervous back there.
I know, I will be too.
But tell, if you don't mind, tell the Horn family a little bit about Dr. Suri.
Jeremy is, I've never personally met him, only through the exchange of emails, do I know him at all. Jeremy is a close friend of John Kaminsky, who's been with us for a number of years, who's done the ratification project at the University of Wisconsin. And Jeremy Suri was a professor, a foreign policy professor in the history department at Wisconsin for 10 years. And he just recently has moved to the University of Texas in Austin. He's got an endowed chair there, the Mac... I can't remember the exact name of it, so I won't guess. But it's an endowed chair at the University of Texas in Austin. And I called John, and basically what I said is we need somebody that can raise some of the key issues related to the idea of foreign policy from the perspectives of the founders. Somebody that can basically connect the ideals and the values and the vision of the founders to, you know, in a way that gives us a way to look at the whole span of American foreign policy through a different lens. And he said the first name that comes to mind is Jeremy Suri. He says he's one of the most creative, innovative people in the area of American foreign policy there is. And he mentioned one of his books on the founders and the extent to which our foreign policy is driven by the ideas of the founders. So I read the book. It's called Liberty's Surest Guardian. It's won all sorts of awards. I immediately made the decision that when we do the online graduate class in the spring on foreign policy, that's going to be one of the books that we're going to have our teachers read. So I emailed Jeremy, and I just said, you know, I told him who I am and what I was asking. I said, I went to graduate school. John Kaminsky and I have been friends for more than 40 years. And basically his response to me was, everything in my life has been positive since I came to the University of Texas. If there's something I miss more than anything else after leaving Madison, it's having coffee every morning and chatting with John Kaminsky. And so basically he said, he obviously connected with John, and he basically said, you know, I'd love to do this. This is exciting. He was supposed to be, he was in Munich all summer teaching over there in Germany. And Austria, I guess. And basically, we made arrangements to connect him from there via Skype. And of course, we had to postpone because of the storms here in West Virginia, and we're doing it this Friday. He's back in Austin, so we're going to basically do him by interactive video, on Skype on Friday. This is a new thing for us because it gives us opportunity to bring back the Kaminskys and the Blisses and all of these people from their own homes, from their own offices, that ultimately we can be able to bring these people and use technology to basically make these people available to everybody. And not only audio-wise, but visually as well. And I think, you know, and again, this is an example of what we're learning. I mean, you're right. I'm sure you're nervous about Friday, and so am I. But the reality is, once we can make this work, then we don't have to physically bring people across the country or halfway around the world to basically be on the air. We can go where they are and get them, and we can bring the very best.
It turns history into a candy store, doesn't it?
Oh, God, it's fabulous. You know, and I already emailed, and Bob, you know from last, you know Stanley Cutler from last summer. Stanley, I emailed him this past weekend, and I asked him if we were able to do this, would he join us this fall? Because what the online class we're doing that we'll be doing the chats on, is on human rights and civil liberties and the Constitution. And that's Stanley, I mean, that's Stanley Cutler's, wheelhouse, you know. I mean, I had him in graduate school for constitutional history. And you know, I just, it's one of the most fabulous educational experiences I ever had in my life. This guy is great. He's in his 80s. But I asked him, and he said, you tell me, he said, I would love to be on. You just tell me what the parameters are, what we're going to talk about, and we'll set it up and we'll do it. So I know we got him, and I know, and John Kaminsky has told me any time, and John just knows more about the founders and about the people. The other day I asked John, last week in an email, and he said, you really need, you know, I've got a lot of the stuff available on CDs and all of this other stuff. He sent me an attachment to an email, which is his bibliography. Bob, his bibliography is 4 pages long of books he's written.
Holy cow.
Written and edited. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. He's written like 27 or 28 books on the Constitution. And he talks about the books he's got in work. He's got 2 or 3 on the line that he's working on now. I mean, he just lives in this period. And basically, what he's doing is he's basically leaving us, all of us. He's leaving us what he knows. He's not going to leave this earth with the information that only he has. He's basically doing what he can do to make sure that everything he knows, we're going to know. And I think it's one of the most noble experiences and noble things that anybody could do. I think, in my mind, he's one of our heroes. Because John knows more than any person alive about the origins of this political system, and he's basically doing everything he can do to make sure that we all have it when he's no longer with us. And I just think it's fabulous.
Beyond that, it's noble.
And
you know,
the fact that we can get him on Skype and we can get him on the air is just going to be incredible.
And, I mean, he had a real impact on Ferg. He gave Ferg one of his pamphlets on Madison.
Yeah.
And getting Ferg to read something at his age is a real challenge.
Yeah.
And Ferg sat down and devoured it.
Yeah. I mean, he basically talks about these people like you talk about your next-door neighbor, because they are his next-door neighbors.
Well, it was so neat. I guess it was, yeah, it was last year when he had that sample, and just the this was just proof of the depth of the analysis and the scholarship. He had a sample of, what was it, 18th century handwriting.
Yes.
And he passed it around the room, and yeah, I looked at it and put my glasses on and looked at it again, and all of a sudden I felt like I didn't read English anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And he had George Washington's, I mean, he could forge George Washington's name on a check. He's got George Washington's signature down pat. And he went up on a blackboard, took a piece of chalk, and basically put George Washington's signature there in a way you'd swear to God it was his. It's unbelievable. John's a special resource. I mean, he really is. And there
are others out there.
Oh, they're out there. Yeah. And hopefully, and again, I'm as anxious about Friday as you are. But I think I've read Jeremy Suri's thing on American nation building, and all you got to know on the book jacket of his book is that he basically says nation building is so important in understanding America's priorities in the world, because nation building is part of the nation's DNA. And he basically talks about the founders and the ideas of the founders and how it's reflected in the process of nation building and what we're trying to do and why we feel like we should do it, and where we've been successful, where we've not been successful. He talks about Vietnam. He talks about Iraq. All of it in terms of what we're trying to do and where we went haywire and where we're on target. And it's just incredible. It's just incredible. And so I'm really looking forward to Friday. I just, like you, I hope it works. And not only for what he can bring, but once we know that we can make this work, we can access other people who can bring their expertise as well. And it's not just going to come to a classroom of a group of people who are professional educators. It's going to be basically out there for anybody who wants it. And our job is going to be to build that group. Is to basically create more and more people who want it, and if we can get them to want it, and then we can deliver it, and turn that into even more people that want it, then that's what this is all about.
And I think that's where the beginning of the change comes.
Yep.
Dr. Bill, thank you so very much.
Oh, hey, this is great. You know, you ask me the right question, and I just go. I just love it. I think that this is, that what you are doing and what your audience is doing, I think that this is incredible in terms of the potential that it brings.
Well, if nothing else, I hope I've sort of reassured you a little bit, Bill, because folks don't know it, but we've had conversations of late where you said, "Gee, Bob, I don't know if I can fill up 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, ad infinitum."
I don't know if I can do it. I've got the founders with me. Hopefully, many of them.
Right, and you pretty much just did.
It's going to be
like riding a bicycle, falling off a log, water off a duck's back. This is going to be magnificent. It's going to be exciting. And I think this is a real profound step forward.
You know what we ought to do, Bob? You and I have kicked around what we can call the program. We ought to ask your listeners for ideas.
That's a great idea.
You and I have talked about it. So you can basically share with them some of the things we've talked about. But I'm really interested in what we ought to call this. Ultimately I think we're gonna try to do some advertising. We're gonna try to get people who never gave it a try before and try to get them to at least give us a chance. And if we can come up with something that we can call it that might be a little bit challenging or a little bit enticing, it would be great. And I'm guessing that some of the people who are listening probably have a lot better ideas in that area than we do.
And frankly, I don't know who's on in that slot right now, Bill, but I'm willing to hazard a guess that right or left, progressive, conservative, call it what you will, what we are about to go back into is going to be unlike anything else being broadcast at that time anywhere in this country.
Wow.
And I'm utterly convinced of it, because this is not going to be that soundbite driven. This is a beautiful further manifestation of the concept of conversation radio. It's going to be intense. It's going to be scholarly, yes, but neighborly at the same time. And all of those things coming together make for something that is simply not being done right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the reason I'm so all fired excited about it.
I am too. I'm challenged by it, and I have my fingers crossed, and I'm nervous about it. But at the same time, I think it's something that needs to be done. And maybe there are people who eventually come along who can do it better. But right now, it's us. So
yeah.
Let's do it.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you Thursday morning.
Okay, Bob.
Until then, if you need anything, give me a holler.
And we've got Willis Nordlund on Thursday morning, and he's an economist, and he's going to focus primarily on the origins of organized labor. and the whole idea of workers having rights. And because that's what we're talking about is civil rights, human rights, and civil liberties. And so he's going to ultimately be talking about workers' rights. And I think it's incredible. He's one of the most knowledgeable people on labor history that there is.
You've had him on the chat sessions, and he was there last year at the Summer Academy.
Right.
And this is going to be nothing if, well, you haven't brought anybody into the PRISM Summer Academy who hasn't just, absolutely been dynamic. I'm just trying to figure out a way to get Pete back on and, that, because, you know, what a,
We'll do that. Figure out a way.
That was an amazing segment last year.
Oh, I'll tell you, Pete Ballard is absolutely a treasure. I mean, he is absolutely a gem, and he's 81 years old, and you'd never know it.
He's 81 years old and could outrun me in a foot race.
Oh my God!
I have no doubt of it.
His mind and his enthusiasm and his wit, he's just incredible. And he's one of those people that basically says, you know, nobody wants to hear me. And he just can go on and on and on, and he's just got everybody in the palm of his hand. And he's just wonderful. So we'll find a way to get him on too, Bob.
I think that would be wonderful. Okay. Dr. Bill, thank you so very much. I've probably taken up more of your time than you intended to give.
I love it, obviously. I really enjoy it. This is what it's all about.
All right. You take care,
thanks,
Dr. Bill.
Buddy.
See you Thursday morning.
See you Thursday.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And that was Dr. Bill O'Brien. I don't know anybody quite like Dr. Bill. Dr. Bill, among other things, I'm back in radio because of Dr. Bill. Because the first time Dr. Bill had something similar to the PRISM Academy going on was back in 2003, and he needed to be away from the microphone there at Terrestrial Radio in Beckley for a good portion of the summer. And I got brought in as the fill-in guy instead of running reruns. And that was my return to radio. That summer of, 9 years ago. And Jesus, it was magic. And, you know, I think you've probably heard Malloy say that radio is a great job and a terrible business, and it's also been said that it is a bug whose bite is terminal, or not terminal, but incurable. And it proved to be incurable. And everything that has happened since then has happened because Dr. Bill opened a door for me in the summer of 2003. And his commitment and his passion and his knowledge all combine to make for someone the likes of whom, if you were not with the Horn family when he was doing his show a few years back, then maybe you don't have a complete understanding. If, when we start this, you tune in daily, you will have the benefit of practically everything that Dr. Bill has to share about the foundations of this country. And that is a tall offer, but I have no doubt of its accuracy. So we're looking to get started sometime after Labor Day. The date has not yet been fixed. I've got to go over and work up put back together Dr. Bill's studio. We've got to answer a bunch of questions like whether or not he wants to try to do video from his home studio. He mentioned being technologically challenged. Well, he's not so technologically challenged he couldn't get on the air every day. So I have no doubts as to his abilities. I don't understand what you're asking, Mr. Gibson, in the chat room. Will we have access to the raw files, not internet URLs? could, and there's some latency involved with the internet, so bear in mind it'll take a couple of minutes for Mr. Gibson in the chat room to answer me. But tell me what you mean by that. And that answer will come in presently. Great crowd in the chat room this evening. Thanks, everybody, for wandering by on this Tuesday evening. And a reminder, we will have a regular show tomorrow evening as well, most likely on Friday evening, not entirely certain, though. And then as far as programming next week is concerned, I have to leave on Monday and go to a Mountaintop Oval meeting that, let's see, 14th, 15th. Yeah, that'll take up the rest of the week, but then we'll come back and be something, well, you know, normal's only a setting on a dryer. Thank you, Peter Godbold. So next week is probably shot. I apologize, but it'll be reruns. My apologies. Well, the video, okay, I understand now, Mr. Gibson. There's no way I can get the video to you because video is huge files. And, you know, it will go up. It'll go up on, if we do video, it'll go up on Ustream. But the problem is you are severely limited in what you can do with Ustream before you have to start paying them for your storage. And that runs out to about $100 a month and more as time goes on. So that's the limitation there, because, frankly, the funding has not been secured yet for the center that Dr. Bill was describing. So it may start out as only audio, in which case it'll all be archived at White Rose, because Dr. Bill already has an archive there of his previous shows. I hope you will spread the word about this once we have an official starting date. Because I'm not kidding when I say that this will be unlike anything anybody else has ever done. You know, there's a lot of people out on the radio, I'm not one of them, who bill themselves as being really, really super duper, oh my God, worship at my shrine smart. It seems like some talk host or another is coming out with a book every 15 minutes. Well, you haven't heard, and you haven't heard Brilliantly Intelligent until you hear what Dr. Bill brings to the discussion when he gets going talking about the origins of this country. You know, one of the darn... There's so many things to talk about when I talk with him. I meant to tell him about the Loudoun County Museum, because I have a feeling that Dr. Bill could probably do an hour without even batting an eyelash on what it means when individual counties are willing to just give up on their history. Because a lot of what informs, if I may dare speak for him, a lot of what informs Dr. Bill is the fact that there is so much that is not known and so much that is untaught. It is as if somewhere along the way the history of this country was treated as unnecessary and disposable. And that's why Senator Byrd secured the grant funding to create PRISM, because he saw his... having learned American history as being something integral to his life and the civic life of the nation. And that's the way this is going to be treated when Dr. Bill comes back to the horn. Well, we're about 22 minutes away from the end of the program. Let me see if we've still got a caller here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, sir.
Well, Jim, you are there. Okay, great. Wonderful. Good evening.
Oh, yeah, I'm here. And I've enjoyed very much your conversation with Dr. O'Brien. And I've had my history as a professional educator from, secondary school through adult education. And, you know, as far as curriculum building is concerned, there's one key element I think is very important. And I just want to throw this out, okay?
Sure.
And that is needs assessment. Whenever you start any type of curricula, you need to have a needs assessment tool. And I guess what we hear over Radio Rwanda and some of the other things that we hear every day on the media is a pretty good element of a needs assessment tool. And that needs assessment tool basically illustrates what is wrong, what is right, what has been correctly disseminated and incorrectly disseminated, depending on people of all ages. But my most rewarding experiences as an education officer for the federal government has been the adult learner. They're motivated. They're willing. They have accomplishments that they need to fulfill. And they are not driven by some of the stuff that kids are in, you know, secondary school and stuff like that.
No, they're there because they want to be there, not because they have to be there.
Motivation is a very key element there. And the second thing is, and I really applaud your efforts to establish this program. And I hope, I don't know if this technologically is possible, that it can be somewhat interactive in which people can call in and ask questions.
Oh, I think that's a key component of it. The trick, of course.
You had one of the elements there, and I think I was the only one who called.
Oh no! There were others. I remember the day that Bill got a call from Panama, and it completely blew his mind.
Really?
Yeah. Betsy would call from time to time. There were a number of others, but. You know, this is it's a challenge because you've got to, like it or not, it's in competition with other programs. And like I said, I don't even know who they are. But given time and given a little bit of patience, he will build up a body of work that will speak for itself. And I think you know that as well or better than I do. But the other thing though is that it is. They say that in modern media, finding one's niche is everything, Jim. And I'm not kidding. There is nothing, no one, nowhere, doing anything even remotely like what Dr. Bill can and will do.
Well, that's very important. And it's very important for people not only to ask questions, but to surface their own opinions. For example, like they do on C-SPAN on Sunday morning and stuff like that when you have callers. Unfortunately, that is so political.
Well, and it also...
people who are calling who have basically, you know, generated their own opinions that they're just calling to and me.
Well, I think they poison the process at C-SPAN, Jim, when they say you've got to call in on the Republican or the Democrat line or the Independent line.
Somebody who's already formulated what they're going to say, and all they want to do is to hear themselves on the TV.
Or they want their prejudices or their bigotries confirmed.
Exactly. And
but there will be an interactive component, and eventually, you know, who knows where it can go, how interactive that can become. Now, the trick will be to get people, and this is some stuff that we still have to go over, to get people, and I hate this word, but I can't think of a better one at the moment, Jim, to get people doing their homework. If Bill says on Monday, tomorrow we're going to talk about Article 5 of the Constitution, then we need people willing to be of goodwill and do that work.
Well, Bob, I've always maintained that learning is also what you take home and look at night. And that's an important factor.
Absolutely. And none of these old primary source documents, for instance, and I would highly recommend, because I know what a reader you are, look up de Crèvecoeur's letter, What is an American? I think by the time it's not much, you'll be done with it in 5 or 10 minutes. But by the time you're done with it, you will understand why we had such an absolutely fascinating discussion of it this morning.
Well, listen, I wish you both the very best and enjoyed the conversation tonight, and you take care.
Well, thank you, Jim. You have a good night. And if you read it, let me know.
I will.
And thanks for the Victory at Sea reference last night. I enjoyed that before bed.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I grew up watching that with my father whenever it was on. I'd sit down and watch it with him because, of course, his experience in the Second World War had been naval.
Well, you know, I thought about that. And, you know, you hear a great deal about Victory at Sea. And I think there were like 26 elements of that program. And I remember as an interlude, Beneath the Southern Cross.
Right.
Which
right.
was also given.
Oh, that thing had a lot of effort put into it. You know, the score was by Richard Rodgers.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, it called Southern Cross, it was called No Other Love Have I. But it's a beautiful piece of music.
Indeed. All right, well, Jim, have a good night.
Good night.
Bye now. Our good friend Jim, and a long time listener to Dr. Bill from way back. Well, I guess it's time to get close to wrapping up, and I hate to do it on a downer. Jesus, he's already gone. About an hour and 45 minutes ago, a man died. Here is the manner of his death. Tuesday, August 7th, 2012. With one obvious English word and another that makes sense only to lawyers, a man was sent to his grave. Tuesday, August 7th, 2012, certiorari denied. Wilson, Marvin L. V. Thaler, Director, Texas DCJ. The application for stay of execution of sentence of death presented to Justice Scalia and by him referred to the court is denied. The petition for a writ of certiorari is denied. Insofar as it was presented, this petition for writ of certiorari to Justice Scalia, one cannot help but think the act was futile. Marvin Wilson was convicted on the testimony of his co-defendant, who got a plea bargain deal, much like Jared Lee Loeffner's, that gave him life in prison in exchange for testimony against Marvin Wilson in a murder case in Texas. Marvin Wilson has been killed by the state of Texas. Marvin Wilson had an IQ of 61. He went to the Texas Death Chamber at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. The Supreme Court has previously ruled that executing the mentally retarded is unconstitutional. But Marvin Wilson's case was tried in such a way that the jury could not have known that he was mentally disabled. The Bill of Rights, so much in discussion over the course of the last day and a half at the PRISM West Virginia Summer Academy, the Bill of Rights precludes cruel and unusual punishment. How cruel is it to kill a man in the name of the people of the United States of America or the people of the state of Texas? How cruel is it to kill that man who may not even understand the nature of the crime he committed. Marvin Wilson was not like the man who gunned down Sikh worshipers with a firearm that he had purchased legally. He was not like Jared Lee Loeffner, who gunned down people in a grocery store parking lot in Tucson, Arizona, with a firearm he had purchased legally. He was not like a man who, with legally purchased firearms, blew away a theater full of moviegoers. He was a man who could not comprehend the idea of reading. His brain didn't work right. But we have a man sitting on the Supreme Court of the United States of America named Antonin Scalia, who has in the past opined that there is nothing in the Constitution of the United States which confers a right on an American citizen not to be wrongly executed. And this was not necessarily one of those cases. Marvin Wilson may have done what he was alleged to have done, although, of course, the testimony tendered by someone under a plea bargain is always at least somewhat suspect. We act, if you go and watch or listen to the PRISM discussions, we act not upon our beliefs but upon our self-interests. But if you cannot even formulate those self-interests or the beliefs, how can one's act have been said to have been even remotely intentional or voluntary? Or knowing. But this is America, and Antonin Scalia sits in judgment of us all and would as easily order any of us to our deaths as he would shoo away a buzzing fly, because he is a brutal, hateful, nasty old man with no reverence for life, despite the fact, of course, that he's pro-life, pro-fetus. I'm sure that if Marvin Wilson had been a fetus, Antonin Scalia would have been all for saving him. But because Marvin Wilson was a man of limited mind and darker skin, Marvin Wilson had to die. As that great aristocrat, that great patrician, member of the Supreme Court of the United States, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., once wrote, "Three generations of imbeciles is enough." He wrote that in the majority opinion that upheld the involuntary sterilization of a poor woman. So I'm sure that tonight, Fat Tony will sit down, if he hasn't already, to a tasty dinner. And there will be hardly a thought, if any, for Marvin Wilson. Mr. Gibson, I think you're probably right. In the chat room, he notes, "I'm sure they're closet eugenicists. Killing the mentally retarded is probably emotionally to them a public service." Just saying. It's just the truth. What harm would there have been to the state of Texas to simply see that man live out his days behind bars in an already brutal prison system? contemplating, as apparently Scalia was convinced he was able to, the nature of his crime. There would have been no harm to a single solitary individual in the entire state of Texas. But he had to die. Because that's the kind of country we are. If you think we're not, get over it. The state of Texas has just executed a mentally retarded man, even though the Supreme Court has already held that you can't do that. He had to be repeatedly instructed on how to cut the grass. He couldn't read. He couldn't keep up when trying to play a pickup game of football. He couldn't understand how to run a simple play. He couldn't properly dress himself. He couldn't coordinate colors. He couldn't match socks. He wore his belt so tightly that it came near to cutting off his circulation because he didn't understand belts. He couldn't button his shirt properly. In his work life, he worked at a car wash, at the drying station, but he was fired because he didn't know how or couldn't remember how to wipe a car dry in Texas heat. If the process required logic, he couldn't do it. His full-scale IQ of 61. That placed him in intellectual ability below the first percentile. And Texas couldn't wait to kill him. One wonders perhaps if George Bush is sitting around making sport of him, as he did Carla Faye Tucker.
Please don't kill me.
Maybe Rick Perry called him and they giggled together, the killers. Sorry to end like that, but as Arthur Miller says in Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid. So thank you all. I look forward to tomorrow night. Check out the Prism videos if you want. I strongly encourage you to do so. These have been two magnificent days. Thank you to everybody who makes all of this happen. Thank you for the kind contribution that came in during the course of the program. That pushed us $25 closer to our goal, and it is much appreciated. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Lottie and Sparky in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, our blogger, Texas Betsy, John Fox, trying to recover from a vicious bout of the flu. Get better, brother. Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Everything that happens here happens because of the good work of Ben Birch. And thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. Go to AICACT.org and learn what you can do to help end the Appalachian apocalypse of mountaintop removal. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.